Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on this Aloha Friday, July 25th. Sugarcane and pineapple are some of Hawaii's best-known native crops, but today we're bringing you a Hanaho show, highlighting some lesser-known specialty crops and the farmers who grow them. We revisit the story behind an olive farm and learn about orchards tucked away in Kula. We meet a multi-generational farming family that continues a persimmon legacy on the Valley Isle, harvesting from fruit trees first planted more than a century ago. Do cashews have a future here in the islands? We hear from a North Shore farmer who gave away hundreds of seeds to encourage others to start growing them. We also listen back to our conversation with a couple who farmed together and cared for more than 200 cashew trees on Kauai. And got sushi rice? We talk about growing this favorite island staple on the Garden Isle. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Maui's Jamie Woodburn says he doesn't care much for eating olives, but he does like growing them. We talked to Woodburn just as he was winding up his harvest at the end of October. There were record yields, and he says the future looks bright as the upcountry olive orchards have matured. Woodburn has taken part in the Made in Hawaii County Festival in the past and is looking at ways to expand his business.
We've probably planted somewhere between 12 and 15,000 trees. Our orchard has about 2,000 trees in it, and it's located at 4,000 feet. And we've been milling oil for about 7 years.
I just saw on your website that supply to a lot of the local restaurants there on the island. You also, send your product to some of the chefs here on Oahu?
Some of the chefs have requested the oils. There's a chef that grew up on Maui out at Kahala, and we've sent him some oil. We just sent Alan Wong some oil, and a number of chefs here on Maui. So it's very popular. It's obviously limited in supply. We really don't have it on retail yet until we get all of the permitting issues resolved. But it's intentionally peppery and grassy and pretty complex. It's not at any level a boring oil.
Okay, good. I don't like boring. I like spicy and bold.
Yeah.
How is it over there in Kula? I mean, I know, everybody was very afraid when we heard about the wildfire spreading up in that area, but you were spared during this disaster.
Yes, we were. There's a number of orchards. Well, almost all the producing orchards are in Kula, and no one was really threatened by any of the Kula fires. We all were pretty on top of it in terms of just watching where the fire was going. There wasn't a whole lot we could have done if the wind shifted and brought the flames into our orchards. But olive trees generally are very resilient. I mean, in Europe, many of them have burned many times. Some of them have frozen with snowstorms, and I mean, it's tough. You got to work hard to kill an olive tree. They're resilient. They come back. Most of the large growers in Kula all have intentionally pruned our trees this year. So we should, in another year, year and a half, have an even larger harvest than we had this year.
Yeah. So how was this year's harvest?
Well, for those that pruned before or right after flowering, there was almost no harvest because olives come on last year's wood. But there were a few orchards that we harvested. We just finished harvesting an orchard with 157 trees in it and got nearly 6,000 pounds. So it was record-breaking in terms of yield. And we expect that if we all come back from the pruning that we just did, we should all have good years next year. But it's totally weather-dependent. I mean, it's water, wind. We get tropical rainstorms when our trees are flowering, so that's always a challenge. Yeah, growing olives in the tropics has its own unique set of challenges.
Well, I think some folks might be wondering, is our climate really suitable for that?
It is at elevation. If you're not at elevation, the trees will grow and they'll look wonderful, but you won't get any fruit. So for people that put in orchards, let's say below 1,000 feet, we get called occasionally and asked, what can we do to make our orchard productive? And there's really no easy answer other than moving. They need the chill. They need so many hours at or below 50 degrees. And you're not going to get that unless you're at least 2,000 feet. If you go too high, you go above 4,500, then you're in the cloud and you never get any of the summer heat. So it's a little bit of a fickle crop, but it's got its own unique microclimate that it seeks out. And Maui and the Big Island, for sure, have suitable climates for olives.
Are there special fertilizer needs? I mean, I recall doing a thing with a cashew farmer on Kauai, and he had a chicken tractor and basically was using chicken manure, and he just rotated it through his orchard.
Well, most of our consultants have advised us to use fertilizers low in nitrogen because there's an abundance in the soils that we're working with. And their explanation is you want to grow trees that produce fruit, not leaves. And when we do fertilize, we use fertilizers that are general, that have been developed for Hawaii and have all the micronutrients, but hopefully are intentionally low in nitrogen.
As a small business, I mean, what are you looking at as far as scaling up or getting into retail? What are the barriers for you? Is it just you just don't have enough product?
That's one of the barriers. That's going to hopefully resolve itself. There's four 2,000 tree orchards on Maui, so there's going to be a whole lot more oil. But the major barrier is regulatory. It's getting the regulatory agencies to understand that we're dealing with fresh cut fruit. We're not dealing with anything other than that. To suggest that there's a hazard with the olive oil has been a challenging issue that we're still working to resolve. But once resolved and we can get it on retail shelves, I think there'll always be more demand than there is product. If we just couldn't possibly grow enough to supply the local need.
When we think of things like macadamia nut, and they have the discard and the whole pressing process as well, and right, they're always looking for value added, right? How can you use what you would normally throw away and turn it into something else, into another moneymaker?
Right. Well, there are people that have contacted us from spas and people that want to make soaps with the byproduct. There's ranchers that raise pigs who want to try it out to supplement their food. On the mainland, it's often used to supplement pig food. Not so much sheep and cattle because the pits are still in the product that comes out of the mill, but we'd also like to compost it. It's great composting, and we've used it historically for dust control in our orchard. So there's a wide range of uses of everything in addition to the oil. I think at this point, our biggest challenge is to educate the regulators so they understand it. I think they're overreacting to the word oil. If we said we were making olive juice, it might be a whole different story.
I see. So really, it's just what state health department rules and regulations that you're trying to work through?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, mostly the wastewater aspect of it. But I'm confident that we'll get there. And now that we have to move our mill because it's located on a piece of property that was sold, we'll be able to address whatever it is that makes sense. It doesn't make sense to us to just put this material into a septic system. It'd turn to cement. So I know we'll get there. It's just going to take some time and meetings with the right people.
And can you talk about your experience with, let's say, other products that you're getting involved in? And I know there's so many different programs now where they want to try and encourage folks to get into these cottage industries and to scale up.
I've been involved with the production of lilikoi butter for over 35 years, and the demand for anything with lilikoi, like olive oil, has increased. I mean, people want to use olive oil for cakes, for cooking, for dessert items, for inclusion in ice cream and stuff like that. And lilikoi butter has moved on from just being sold in a jar to being sold in volume, mostly to bakers who want to use it in cookies or other products. And there's just not enough, like olive oil, there's just not, I don't think there's anybody that grows lilikoi in the state of Hawaii at a commercial level. I don't think there's anybody. I used to grow about 4,000 pounds a year for use. I just haven't been able to replace that. And, you know, Maui has a couple of big players like Mahi Pono who have the perfect elevation, the perfect growing conditions, and maybe we can convince them, or even small farmers, all you need. If you had an acre of lily koi, you'd produce tons, literally.
And I know there is that Maui Product Development Center there at Maui College, but I don't know, are there any programs that you found to be useful in helping to bring your product to market?
Yeah. In the early phases, we were involved with the Innovation Center at the culinary school, and that's where we made all of our product, bottled all of our oil, and they've been very helpful. And we've had very recent discussions, as recent as last week, where we're scheduling time in their newer kitchen where we can make, instead of making 18 bottles of lily koi butter at a time, we can make 30 cases at a time. So we're going to use that new equipment, see if it works, and then develop a relationship with them to do that either monthly or weekly or whatever the demand requires. But again, there's much more demand than there is product.
And so if you had a wish list to help you either scale up or produce, you know, more of your product, what would that be?
If I had a magic wand, well, I'm sure the number one on everybody's list is money. But for us, the problem that I look at that we're going to face and already have faced is harvest crews. I mean, I work for 16 weeks harvesting our olives this year. And the olive growers on Maui would have harvest work probably for 4 months for crews that could come in and harvest those olives probably between August and November. You know, the other magic wand item would be to just get past the regulatory nightmares and just get on with business, because it's taken us 12 years to get to this point. And now that our trees are really beginning to produce, it would be nice just to focus on production and bottling and sales and distribution, because, you know, everybody that samples or tastes our oil wants to know how they can get volume. That's our biggest challenge.
All right. Okay. Well, I appreciate your time, and I'm glad your harvest is over so you've got some time to chat with us.
Yeah. I'm way happy that the harvest is over.
That was Jamie Woodburn, owner of Maui Olive Company, talking to us about the challenges of starting and growing a small business. And a fun side note, Woodburn also offers a line of lily koi butters. Today's show is a rebroadcast of interviews we've had about growing specialty crops. Up next, we'll visit a fourth-generation persimmon farmer. And did you know we have cashew orchards in the state? More on that after the break.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. Now on view, Mary Cassatt at Work. The Impressionist dared to take the lives of women seriously as subject matter for her art. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Aloha, this is Joe Uno. I'm proud to be a Hawaii Public Radio contributor and incoming board chair, because it's important to me that all of us here in Hawaii have access to these services. Join me in strengthening and protecting HPR by starting or upgrading your monthly financial contribution. Go to HawaiiPublicRadio.org and click Donate.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, with a mission to provide fresh water to the people of Oahu, committed to conserving and protecting Oahu's water resources since 1929. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
In a few short months, it will be persimmon season. Now we take you back to 2020 when we sat down with a kula farmer to learn about the popular fall fruit. These seasonal gems are sweet, honey-like in flavor, and are often likened to apricots. Local fans of these know all about the persimmons grown in Kula. Started more than a century ago, the multi-generation Hashimoto family farm was recently restructured. Three brothers, John, Noel, and Clark, have each carved out a piece of the business. We talked to one of them, Clark Hashimoto, who was harvesting trees that his grandfather planted more than 100 years ago.
You know, we're hopeful that my son will take over, my daughter, or my grandson, you know, but because it's a seasonal crop, you know, it's hard to make a living just on 2 or 3 months. So, you know, what we're trying to do is just see if the tradition can keep on going. Right now, my grandson is, you know, he just got back from junior college. He got his associate degree, and so he's helping us out on the farm now because it's just a family-run farm, you know, myself and my wife.
Well, what's involved in keeping this tradition going, you know, for your family? You know, describe a typical day.
Well, you know, during the season, a typical day is what we're doing right now is we're harvesting every single day and we sell out every single day, you know, so it's really hard to keep up, you know, because it depends on if the fruits ripen or not. If they don't ripen in time, you know, we can't harvest. So right now we're harvesting every day and my wife, Jackie, takes care of the sales, you know, at the farm because a lot of the customers are walk-ins or they call in and place an order and they come to pick it up. In the past, we used to have a lot of people come from Oahu, Hawaii, or even the Big Island to pick up the persimmon, you know, and komodas and samsatos, whatever it is, and then they just make a day and they go back. So because of the pandemic, we've opened it up to mail order to the neighbor island.
Oh, there
so
you
we're
go.
We're shipping like 20-25 boxes every week, mainly to Oahu.
And tell us about the types of persimmons that you grow there.
First off is what we have now is the Maru, M-A-R-U. It's a stringent type of persimmon that's come in early, which is good. And it's a yellow-green in color. It's astringent, so what we have to do is we use dry ice to cure the puckerness. We leave it in 1 pound of dry ice and 40 pounds of persimmon for 24 hours. And then in a day or two, you can eat them. So they're still crispy. And this is very sweet. So secondly, we have the fuyu, which is the most common one. You know, California sends all their fuyus to Hawaii. So this type of variety, we don't have to cure. So you can harvest, wash it, and, you know, sell it right away.
So it's not that tart. It's sweet.
Well, it's sweet, but not as sweet as the maru. The process is, you know, for the maru is that you got to pick it, you got to cure it, then you got to take it out, wash, and then we can sell it. But the fuyu, you take it out, and you can wash it and sell it right away. So not as much work.
And then the third type?
And third one is the hachia. It's an oblong type orange variety that you have to eat it soft. So the old folks, you know, they like that. And they when they eat it soft, you know, it's like pudding.
So does that mature a little bit later?
Yeah, in November, second week in November. A lot of Koreans love that. And old Oriental people, you know, they like the hachia.
Tell us about your value-added products.
Yeah, the value-added, you know, first is the dried persimmon. Mainly using the maru fruit that cannot go as a fresh fruit. We peel it and, you know, dehydrate it as a dried persimmon. So that's very popular. You can hardly keep up on that, too. And then we also have persimmon jam and persimmon butter. And this year they're flying out like hotcakes, so, you know, it depends. Sometimes, you know, it's not as popular, but some people are buying a few cases at a time and saying that they're supporting locals. You know, they make, I guess businesses make baskets and they said they want to buy local and support the local, which is, you know, really good.
Yes, and particularly during this time, you know, we've got to find a way to become more resilient and really beef up our food production. So when we look for different products, it's like, what can we shore up? What can we expand if the demand is there?
We didn't know what to expect this year because of the pandemic, if people weren't going to buy and stuff like that. So we're kind of up in the air until the season started and they started coming. Of course, you know, mask is required and social distancing. But we've been having a lot of customers, and we're sold out for the next week and a half, I guess.
Well, that's great.
So yeah, it's great. But
you need more persimmons.
We need more persimmons. Well, you know, when we had one big farm, you know, we could supply everything. But now we got to be more resourceful. And
how many acres does your farm cover now?
My farm now covers about 2.5 acres and maybe 200 trees. So, you know, in the past we had 500 trees, so that, you know, split in three, so.
I see. So then each brother has their own trees?
Yeah, their own trees, yeah.
And so are they doing a similar model, or everybody's doing it their own way? How does that work? I know it can be complicated with families sometimes.
I'm sure, yeah. they're doing their own. I think we're the only ones that are really open every day to the public. Right now, we're open 9 to 3 every day, 7 days a week until the season ends. I plant stuff like, you know, Fuji apples and some other things. So when people come, you know, they walk down the road and they can see all the different things, you know. So it's just not just come pick up and leave. You know, they can kind of walk around, pick their own, but, you know, it's too much liability.
Yeah.
For a small operation like ours.
So what's the biggest challenge, you think, then? Is just being able to stay in business and keep somebody in the family interested in growing persimmons?
You know, for me, I grew up on the farm, and we worked on the farm all this time. And, you know, I took vacations to help, you know, with the persimmons and stuff like that. But now it's one of my sons is, two of my kids are teachers, so they can't really take off, yeah.
Anything else that you want to just share just about persimmons in this time of year? Because everybody's, you know, thinking of pumpkins, but, you know, that's not the only orange fruit out there.
So, you know, we have that Kula Country Farms down the road. So usually they go pick up their pumpkins and they come up here and pick up their persimmons. So it's, you know, we feed on each other.
Right. Tis the season.
Yeah. But, you know, it's not only the harvest. You know, after the harvest, we have to prune every single tree. The upkeep is all year round.
What is it that you love about persimmons?
Well, aside from the tradition, you know, it's, kind of rewarding when you, you know, you see all the fruits on the trees and that all the care that you put into it, you know, is paying off. So, you know, and more people are, you know, we've got different people coming up every year, and so, you know, the fruit itself is very popular. It's not as easy as it seems, yeah. Because other than this, you know, because normally just my wife and I during the week, and then our family comes on the weekends to help. But we have to harvest, you know, to keep up with the orders, so. With my grandson here, it's a blessing because at least we can keep up with the harvest.
We've been hearing from Clark Hashimoto of Hashimoto Persimmons and Products, a fourth-generation farm in Kula. This interview aired in November of 2020. If you're lucky enough to get your hands on one of the Hashimoto-grown fruits, you can appreciate the history of this family's backbreaking work and the niche they've carved out in our community.
Kula morning, near to heaven embracing the sky, as a misty cloud hovers by, revealing the sand and the sea, the sand and the sea. My Kula morning and me.
Welcome back to the Conversation Specialty Crop Hanaho Show. Did you know cashew nuts start out as cashew apples? We reached out to a family farm on Kauai, which had been growing the popular nut for some 20 years. Linda and Scott Newman operated Numana Hui Farms, home to more than 200 mature cashew trees. They harvested 600 pounds of cashews per year. But like other small farmers, they also dabbled in other ventures, including honey and vanilla. We visited them in 2021.
You got the cashew fruit. With that fruit, it makes a juice. It's very high in vitamin C. And so then we go, okay, what can you do with this besides drinking it? So we've actually made the jellies, and that's kind of started branching off from there. And then you do process your cashews. You have a lot of pieces, and what do you do with the pieces? So then you make the cashew butter. And so your product line grows based on what you have on the farm, and that's kind of how we've grown, you know what I mean?
And Scott, talk about what it's been like, because you're far ahead of anybody, I think, in Hawaii when it comes to these trees and what you folks are doing there on your farm.
Well, it's been a process. It takes a while before they get to production level and you get enough nuts to really make it viable for you. And with the value-added products from the cashew fruit, we've been able to utilize, you know, all of our crop. And that's a goal a lot of farmers try to get to. And we're not 100%, but we try to use as much as we can, and we've developed a nice product line with the cashews.
And talk about how you got into cashews.
I happened to be on a trip in Central America, and the driver passed a farm. He said, "This is the largest cashew farm in Central America." And I said, "Cashews? Wow." And then I realized the location was similar to mine here. And I just sort of onesie and twosie the trees, see if they would grow and if I had the right climate, and grew from there. And eventually I grew my own from my own seeds, and just developed the process of harvesting and that as I went along.
And I hear chickens in the background. I remember when I last visited your farm, you had a chicken tractor.
I had a couple. I'd like to say I've retired as a chicken whisperer, but they still hang out here all the time.
Okay.
And I used them to fertilize and to help keep down the grass and things like that. So they're very useful. And we were going to the farmers' markets all the time, and the eggs were a nice product for us too.
And so have you just been selling your product at those markets or online?
We did up until really the virus, which shut everything down here. And at the time, we were developing our own website because we had people who would ask how they get a hold of us other than a market. And so timing just happened to click in where we put our website up online, and now we're selling right from there right now. And of course, local people ask us, but not at the markets because most of them are closed still.
Mm-hmm. And then can you talk about just how, you developed the product line?
So, you start with your fruit, and then cashews come cashew butter. Then you've got cashew brittle, and I love to experiment and cook different things. So I did that actually. Scott's going, "How about cashews and chocolate?" And so in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, we need to touch base with the chocolatier and do chocolates and cashews. But that's how you develop everything. What grows good and what can we do simply, easily? And to be honest with you, my products I try to do with local and anything I can from the farm, except for the brittle, which is I do get sugar. Whatever we can develop. So that's how it goes. And then I look and I see, and somebody will go, "There's a chutney from cashew apple. Is that something people would get?" I don't know. You have to market it. And that's where the farmer's market was good. But that's kind of how we develop. But then you don't want to get too much ahead of yourself. We added things like dried bananas because we have bananas. And
coconut.
Coconut because we have coconut. And then I'm a beekeeper because it's good for the orchard. So you add whatever honey and cashews can produce, And
which added a line of cashew flour honey to our list of things on our farm now. I kind of tell people I'm a little bit of a pioneer. I sort of use the term, I Forrest Gump my way through everything, but I've learned a lot. And
people just have to understand it's not just growing a tree. I get a lot of, I've got a cashew tree. What can I do? Well, to process the nuts from the cashew tree, that becomes an issue. But here's the fruit, and you can do a lot of stuff with the fruit. So to be a cashew farmer, you have to produce enough to, like Scott was saying, make it viable to buy equipment so that you can process it.
Right, because you've got lots of value-added products that you can sell.
Go from there.
But you need the volume.
Yeah.
Correct.
And so how much of your property is in cashews? Have you added more trees since I was last there?
We've done some more, right? I would say about two-thirds of our property is planted out. I'm developing kind of my own variety right now with some trees I have that I grew, I planted, I set, and they've done their own thing, and they're really good trees, so I'm kind of planting with those, too.
And you got those where?
We've got a few trees here on the island when we first started, from nurseries, different varieties. And then from that point, I've kind of grown my own.
That was Scott and Linda Newman, who operated the Numanahui Cashew Farm on Kauai. Since we first aired this segment in 2021, the Newmans have sold the farm and retired. They write, "We enjoy providing the best quality product on the market and grown on the Garden Isle." Coming up next, we showcase an Oahu gentleman farmer who gave away 1,500 cashew seeds to encourage others to get in on the cashew action. Frank Hinshaw is in a niche market. He runs a skydiving business on Oahu's North Shore and a 15-acre farm. He's also the person behind a sweeping effort to bring more cashew production to Hawaii. In 2020, Hinshaw gave away 1,500 cashew seeds to farmers here on Oahu and the Big Island in an effort to encourage more growers to make cashews a thriving nut crop for the islands. We spoke with him in March of 2021.
Hawaii is the only state in the United States that can grow cashew, and presently the United States, Hawaii, import all the cashews consumed, except there's a farm on Kauai.
And so you really see this as an opportunity for us to create a market.
That's right, a new niche market in the nut industry.
And the agriculture officials tell me that wherever a kiawe tree grows, you can grow a cashew tree.
I would agree with that. Once the tree is established, it's going to need, for the first year anyway, special care, watering, that sort of thing, to make sure it takes good, especially if it gets a leaf blight or something like that. I'm pleased with the cashews. We planted cashews from the 2020 crop, just planted the last of them this week. But the ones that we planted in May of 2020, some are, well, the highest one I would say is 8 feet tall now. Some of them are flowering in their first year, which is interesting. I want to follow the seeds from those cashews to see if that's unique to that strain or whatever.
And what about pests and blight?
There's a weevil that will attack the leaf on the young plant. The Chinese rose beetle was a concern. There's a leaf blight. I'm not sure whether that's a virus or a mite or something like that that the plants get, causes them to drop their leaves. If they're established already, they seem to survive it and continue. A plant that's less than a year old, especially if it's not getting good irrigation, might succumb to that.
How would we get our nuts to market as far as processing? I understand there was a gentleman who was very interested in trying to get farmers to grow cashews and that he would work out the processing.
Yeah, God bless George Pelosi, Seattle, Washington. Hopefully, the more people that grow cashews, the more likely we can get a cooperative or a grant or something like that to have a processing center on Oahu. I understand that the farmer on Kauai has some equipment. Right now, we process ours by hand and consume them ourselves, so we don't have a product for the market. In 3-5 years, hopefully, we'll have some funds to buy some processing equipment or, like I say, start a cooperative.
And so how many trees do you have in the ground?
We planted about 500. I would say that 400 of them survived the first year.
And there was thought at one point that maybe we could get growers on a particular island like, you know, Molokai or Lanai to pursue this cashew tree as a potential crop.
Well, I don't know. I don't think the opportunity has been presented to them. We were real fortunate. Hawaii is real fortunate to have gotten the rootstock and cashew seedlings that Mr. Pelosi sent over from India. These trees are bred hybrid type trees that produce more seeds, more flowers, So if you can get them pollinated with bees or whatever natural pollinators, we're getting more seeds per plant than what statistics show it should be. We have a very nice larger than commercial cashew nut that should interest the entire market. So I think the future looks bright for Hawaii cashews. If people are interested, send me a note. Henshaw Farms has got a Facebook page. We've got a farm stand here on Oahu, the honey hole on Kaukonahua Road, the old road to Wahiawa from the North Shore. We'll be happy to talk cashews. And this fall, I'm sure we'll have another cashew nut giveaway.
I understand that they can actually grow pretty big in some areas.
I think the largest one takes up an entire city block in Brazil. But picture a mango tree. It's a relative of the mango. The cashews seem to be liking Hawaii. We're pleased with the output of nuts. There's, besides the obvious nut, the cashew apple has some marketable properties. We're working on that. And the shell of the nut is used, if you can extract the oil, as a brake fluid additive, is what I understand.
What got you started into it as a product?
Skydiving is a niche market. Mm-hmm. Everybody isn't going to go skydiving. And so I was interested in niche marketing and farming.
Mm-hmm.
So we have bees, which most farms don't have. And we've tried to get some fruit varieties that, in addition to the cashews, that will make our farm stand out. And try to produce the lemons and limes and soursop, whatever we're producing, make it high quality and desirable so our customers will come back to our farm stand.
That was Frank Hinshaw, a small Oahu North Shore farmer who has taken to cashews and is encouraging others to support the growth of crops like his. If you're just tuning into the conversation, we're airing a Hanaho show about Hawaii farmers who nurture specialty crops to sell locally. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a break.
Support for HPR comes from Aloha Air Cargo, connecting Hawaii by providing inter-island shipping with services including Aloha Next Flight Out, Aloha Standard Overnight, and Aloha Economy. AlohaAirCargo.com.
Enjoy classical music in person with Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton Concert Series. Over four Saturdays starting August 9th, enjoy performances from Clara Kim, Alex Hayashi and Shuo Lee, Megan Conley, and the Honolulu Brass Quintet. Learn more at hprtickets.org, sponsored by HMSA.
KHPR Honolulu, KKUA Wailuku, KANO Hilo, KHPH Kailua Kona, KIPL Lihue, KJHF Kualapu'u, with translators K203EL Hali'iwa, K235CN Waimea.
Did you know that during the U.S. Civil War, Hawaii provided rice to the northern states? It's a little-known fact about the reign of the rice crop here in the island. At the peak of production in 1909, Hawaii had more than 9,000 acres of rice fields, but the industry died out in the 1920s. Koi farmer Jerry Ornelas wants to revive the industry. HPR visited the Garden Isle in 2020 to learn about Ornelas' farm and his efforts to carve out a market for Hawaii-grown sushi rice and table rice.
This is a little winter nursery. It's got 20 different varieties of rice in it. Most of them are Japanica, which are a short grain, but we've also got some other varieties as well. I think the big picture is that we revive the rice industry here in Hawaii, which was once thriving. You know, we're a state of rice eaters, and I think there is a demand for locally grown rice for many, many other uses, everything from table rice to brewing to very high-end sushi rice.
So you think the possibilities are there. We just need to be able to find the right type of rice to grow again?
Yeah, I think, you know, varietal trials are going to be very important. You know, we need to select varieties that do well here. And rice in general does really well in Hawaii. It's amazing how adapted it is to our climate. That relates to why it was once such an important crop here.
Driving around Kauai, you were pointing out areas that all used to be in rice. It's just here and there now. You know, you've got farmers doing research. In order to kind of jumpstart this again, it's going to take a tremendous amount of effort, I imagine.
You know, a lot of the farmers that obviously that used to do rice are no longer with us. So it's going to be a kind of a steep learning curve for us. Fortunately, there's resources out there. There's, you know, the University of Hawaii, there's the Department of Agriculture, the USDA. You know, one of the problems we're having, of course, is finding rice seed, which is really hard to come by.
Talk about that problem.
Yeah, you know, rice is heavily quarantined because of diseases, so virtually impossible to import rice seed from any country into the United States. The other problem we're running into is that a lot of the rice varieties are they're proprietary, so a lot of it has been developed by rice cooperatives whose members, you know, contribute so much per ton of rice that they sell to research. So, you know, it's very difficult. They will not part with the seed. You know, I've been at this for 4 years now. You know, finally, this light at the end of the tunnel, we are able to do some varietal trials now. We've been growing some varieties that are what we refer to as heritage rice varieties, but, you know, we don't know much about the quality of the rice. So we're looking for varieties that are well-recognized. Those would include table rice as well as rice used for brewing and mochi rice.
When you talk rice for brewing, I mean, that could be another niche market. Is the trend now for craft beers and sake?
Mm-hmm. Sochu, sake, craft beers, all of the above. You know, if we can supply brewers with good quality rice, then I think there's real potential for expansion of that.
Talk about the challenges that you've had, either just with water or bugs, birds.
Birds are a huge problem. As you can see, our fields are all netted. You know, water is an issue. It's becoming more and more contentious. You know, rice uses a lot of water. So, you know, we're trying to develop methods. The water comes into the field and then exits, usually back into the same source it came out of. So that's a non-consumptive use. Well, right now we're kind of in the proof of concept phase. We're trying to see what varieties work well, what methods of cultivation work well. Once the proof of concept phase is done, then we're going to start looking at what kind of markets can we access.
And there are other farmers here on Kauai that are testing out rice again.
Yeah, there is one operation on grow farm land that does rice research for a California rice cooperative. And that's been going on for a long time. The University of Hawaii also had a paddy crop station in Wailua where they also did rice research for the California growers. So Kauai is a popular place to do rice. And of course, you know, it's had such a long history.
So it's rice seed is what we're talking about.
Yes, that's correct, rice seed. You know, because we can do a winter crop, which they can't do on the mainland, they look to Kauai to do their winter nursery growing.
And so if there are other folks out there that are interested in experimenting with, you know, kind of like what you're doing here, whether it's here on Kilauea or Oahu, I mean, I don't know, because Oahu used to be covered with a lot of rice paddies as well.
Yeah, the two major rice growing regions in Hawaii at the height of the rice industry was Hawaii and Oahu.
What else is a big challenge?
We got flooded out in April of 2018, and that set the whole project back a year. You know, obviously, you know, rice is much like taro is grown in areas that are prone to flooding. So flooding, you know, with climate change, I think is really going to be an issue. Yeah, one of the saving graces of rice is that it can tolerate brackish water more so than taro. So I think some of those coastal areas will be well suited for rice.
You attended a recent climate change meeting where a number of farmers turned out. What are some of the issues that were discussed at that?
Sources of water, flooding, salt intrusion in the lower elevation farms. You know, the perception that farmers are polluters, that we're contributing to the problem. And to a certain extent, of course, we do use fossil fuels. Some crops, especially paddy crops, contribute methane, which is a very big greenhouse gas. So, you know, how do we, you know, mitigate some of these problems, and how do we respond to questions from the public regarding this?
You also had some ideas about teaming up with the tourist industry, looking for ways that that industry can help our farmers.
Yeah, as it relates to climate change, you know, farmers also sequester a lot of carbon in their farms, as do ranchers. So is there a possibility that there could be some kind of carbon credit exchange, you know, with industries like the airlines, which contribute a lot of carbon to the atmosphere, the cruise industry, tourist industry in general? You know, is there a possibility that we can team up with them and help them to offset some of these carbon?
Help our local farmers survive.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, we have a real problem with profitability in farming in Hawaii, and one of the reasons more people don't farm is that it's not a really lucrative business at this point in time.
Well, you've got this test plot of rice, but you're surrounded by all your trees because you raise everything from lychee to avocados?
That's correct. Yeah, longan, lychee, breadfruit, some avocado, and mostly orchard crops. But if we're serious about feeding ourselves, then we're going to have to look at what it takes to have a very healthy diet, right? Which, of course, includes carbohydrates. You know, leafy greens, great, man, want superfood, right? But, you know, we're going to have to find starches. You know, and we don't grow many grains in Hawaii, and the only grain we can grow here successfully, I think, is rice. And, you know, the fact that we're a state of rice eaters gives me hope that, you know, there may be a potential for this crop. Rice is about a 4 or 5 month crop, depending on the variety that you plant. So, you know, there is the potential for us to do several crops a year.
And as far as pests, what's been the experience so far?
So far, so good. Aside from birds, we don't get much pest damage.
Okay, so that's hopeful then.
Well, you know, we started with a clean slate, and I think we have a real opportunity here. So, you know, I would caution anybody that's interested in growing rice to make sure that whatever seed they do bring in, right, is approved by, you know, the Department of Ag and not something that they've snuck in, right? This could really devastate the industry early on. There's not only pathogens, but also weed seeds that might get into rice. Some would evolve to look almost exactly like rice. And if they get into our crops, you know, it's going to be a major setback.
So you've got to tread carefully as we launch this again.
Yeah, and that applies to all crops, of course, that, you know, we're introducing a lot of new crops now. So I would caution everyone to make sure that you're getting certified seed.
And then the water that you're getting is all gravity-fed at this point?
Yeah, at this point it's gravity-fed. You know, we're having some issues with our irrigation system here on East Kauai, and we don't know, you know, going forward if we're going to have to pump water. You know, so far we've been carbon neutral as far as irrigation goes, but, you know, with the demise of the East Kauai irrigation system, you know, we may have to start pumping water now.
Right, and so what was happening was you had a cooperative. Now that's going away.
Yeah, we stopped operations on December 31st of 2019. You know, the regulatory burden was just getting too heavy for us. As a group, we were kind of aging out, hoping that a younger generation would come along and carry on the work. The system that we use we're taking care of is entirely state-owned. And, you know, we had hoped that it could have been transferred to the Department of Agriculture. And when that didn't happen, we're still working on it, but that didn't happen this year. So, you know, we're hopeful that some solution can be worked out. But right now, it doesn't look very good. This whole exercise, you know, looking at the bigger picture, has to do with, you know, diversifying our economy. We are so dependent on tourism. And, you know, given recent events, pandemics and so on, You know, I'm fearful that at some point the hotel industry or the visitor industry is going to be impacted in a negative way. And, you know, we really need to strengthen our economy and restore agriculture to its rightful place as a driver of our economy, which it once was.
That was Kauai farmer Jerry Ornelas, who is working to spark the interest of local farmers in reviving rice as a local crop. We originally aired this story in 2020. That's it for today's showcase of our stories highlighting farmers who put in long hours to grow specialty crops in our islands. We do have to go now, but next week we hear from former Governor David Ige and get his thoughts on the rule of law. We'd like to hear from you. Call our talkback line and leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and the HPR Digital team. Our intern is Laura Dukes. The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. Theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.